Greetings and welcome to this week's Christian History Program. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer Stacy Wilson. Reading Christian History Magazine, issue number 150, Stories Worth Retelling, our readers' favorites from 150 issues. We stopped last week during an article entitled Surprised by Christ. We were discussing a reluctant convert, C.S. Lewis, who lived from 1898 until 1963. We'll back up just a little bit and dive back into our article. In 1914, Lewis was sent to Great Bookham, Surrey, where W.T. Kirkpatrick, a brilliant teacher and friend of Lewis's father, tutored him. Kirkpatrick initiated Lewis into the world of the Greek and Latin authors in the original languages, launching him into lifelong skills of critique, analysis, and clear thinking and writing. Lewis entered the world of Oxford in 1917 as a student, and he never really left. Despite an interruption to fight in World War I, and as his professorship at Cambridge beginning in 1954, he always maintained his home and friends in Oxford. He loved the bookshops, the pubs, and the Bodleian Library, and he reveled in the company of local men who loved to read, write, and discuss books. By 1924, Lewis was a philosophy tutor at University College, and the following year he was elected a Fellow of Magdalen College, where he tutored in English language and literature. Oxford brought Lewis both a career and a close circle of friends. He would later say repeatedly that over half of human happiness comes from friendship. In his early years at Oxford, he began reading books that later led him to say, quote, "A young man who wishes to remain a sound atheist cannot be too careful of his reading," end quote. And once he met Owen Barfield, Neville Coghill, Hugo Dyson, and J.R.R. Tolkien, the die was cast. Slowly but surely, Lewis moved from atheism into belief in God, and then, by 1929 or 1930, full-blown Christian faith. Between 1933 and his death in 1963, C.S. Lewis wrote such popular books as the 7-volume Chronicles of Narnia, the Screwtape Letters, The Great Divorce, and Mere Christianity. They nudged atheists and agnostics toward the faith and encouraged and nurtured believers. Through these works, letters, and lifelong charity to the needy, Lewis lived out one of his deepest convictions, quote, "There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal," end quote. He followed this conviction through wartime sermons and radio talks, and through answering countless letters from fellow immortals, seeking spiritual advice until nearly the day he passed to his eternal reward on November 22, 1963. Today, the life and work of this spiritual pilgrim and literary scholar still speak to the many thousands around the world walking their own spiritual pilgrimages. This section of the article was written by Lyle W. Dorset. An unlikely evangelist, Commander Mitsuo Fuchida, who lived from 1902 until 1976. Commander Mitsuo Fuchida of the Imperial Japanese Navy Air Service led the first wave of bomber and fighter planes during Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. At 7:40 a.m. on December 7, 1941, he sent up the green flare from his plane, signaling the order to attack. He later ordered his radio operator to send the message, "Tora, Tora, Tora," informing the Japanese that they had achieved complete surprise. The attack on the Hawaiian U.S. Navy base resulted in 2,403 American and 64 Japanese deaths. The following day, the United States officially declared war on Japan and entered World War II. Fuchida served Japan throughout the war. During the conflict, he repeatedly escaped death, from missing a flight run during the Battle of Midway owing to an emergency appendectomy, to being thrown by an explosion that broke both ankles, to being ordered to Tokyo just before his superior, Vice Admiral Kakuji Katua, failed to stop the American liberation of Guam. Had he been with Kakuta, he would have participated with the Vice Admiral in suicide by seppuku. Fuchida was also due to be in Hiroshima when the atomic bomb was dropped on August 6th, but at the last minute he was sent instead to another city. In the bomb's aftermath, he was part of the team that inspected Hiroshima, and he was the only man with them not to die of radiation poisoning. He later recalled that life seemed futile after the war. Quote, "I had missed death so many times, and for what? What did it all mean?" End quote. Later, called on to testify in war crimes trials related to Japanese treatment of prisoners of war, Fuchida felt the trials were a sham. For decades, he had harbored resentment of the Americans because of their own poor treatment of POWs and their severe restrictions on Asian immigration. So he sought out recently released POWs to gather evidence. Among these prisoners, he first met former flight engineer Kazuo Kanegasaki. Rather than the expected story of abuse and torture by Americans, Kanegasaki instead told Fuchida of a young American woman, Peggy Covell, who, despite the slayings of her missionary parents by Japanese soldiers, treated him and his fellow prisoners with kindness. Fuchida was astounded. The code of the warrior demanded revenge, but this woman declined it, offering compassion to Japanese prisoners instead. That sparked Fuchida's interest in Christianity. He encountered the testimony of Jacob DeShazer, an American POW who had found God in a Japanese camp. Deeply moved by his story, Fuchida became a Christian. Quote, "Looking back," he said later, "I can see now the Lord had laid his hand upon me so that I might serve him." Fuchida established an evangelistic association, traveling to share a presentation of his conversion story. In his autobiography, From Pearl Harbor to Calvary, published in 1959, he wrote, quote, "I remember the thrill that was mine when, in one of my first meetings, I led my first soul to Christ in America, and he was one of my own countrymen." Fuchida authored a number of books, including the autobiography and an account of the Battle of Midway. He died in Japan at age 73. This portion of the article was written by Matt Forster. Next, we have A Heart Belonging to Jesus. On Christmas Eve in 1985, a petite Albanian nun stood before microphones and cameras at St. Veronica's Church in New York City's Greenwich Village and spoke, quote, "We want that nobody dies unloved and uncared for. We are hoping that they will be able to live and die in peace by getting tender love and care." She added, "Because Jesus was also born, so I wanted to help them to be born in joy and love and peace." The nun, Mother Teresa, was at the opening of a hospice home for those dying of AIDS during the height of that epidemic. She established many such houses throughout her life. Born Angese Agnes Gonca Bojahiu, who lived from 1910 until 1997, Mother Teresa grew up in the present-day Macedonian capital of Skopje. When she was young, her father died, leaving her mother alone with Agnes and two other siblings. Their strong Catholic faith carried them through the tragedy, Even with little to spare, Agnes's mother impressed a deep sense of generosity on her children, inviting the city's destitute to share the family's food. At 12, young Agnes felt a call to religious life. She left 6 years later to join the Sisters of Laurento in Ireland, where she took the name Sister Mary Teresa. During her novitiate period, she went to Darjeeling, India, and after her first profession of vows, to Calcutta. She learned Bengali and Hindi and taught in a convent-run girls' school for the city's poorest. At 36, Teresa heard Christ commanding her to care for Calcutta's neediest. After 6 months of medical training, she got to work among the forgotten, sick, and dying poor. Soon, she established the Missionaries of Charity and founded homes and health clinics for Calcutta's poor, including a leper colony. In 1969, Malcolm Muggeridge's BBC documentary, Something Beautiful for God, catapulted Mother Teresa and her charitable work from obscurity into world renown. In 1979, she received the Nobel Peace Prize. Donations also poured in to Missionaries of Charity. By her death in 1997, over 100 countries and thousands of missionaries and lay volunteers had joined the Missionaries of Charity, caring for the homeless, the disabled, refugees, lepers, and victims of HIV/AIDS. With renown came controversy. Her traditional Catholic opposition to abortion and contraception drew the ire of secular critics. Her interest in conversion provoked prominent Hindus, and some conservative Christians saw her as a universalist. Anti-theist Christopher Hitchens exclaimed that she had exacerbated institutionalized poverty, accepting the money of dictators to further her religion and provided subpar medical care. For her part, Mother Teresa struggled with doubt. In the end, she reconciled her legacy this way. Quote, "By blood, I am Albanian. By citizenship, I am Indian. By faith, I am a Catholic nun. As to my calling, I belong to the world. As to my heart, I belong entirely to the heart of Jesus." This concludes the article written by Kalina Radcliffe, who is managing editor of Christian History and has been with this magazine since 2012. Our next article is entitled Russian Christianity and the Revolution. What happened? In its original 1988 printing, this article delved into the past, even as Russia was enduring its grievous consequences. The USSR did not officially collapse until 1991. We've updated and condensed this article, but its applications of hope and warning have us reaching for this powerful story 35 years later. It was once known as Holy Russia, a land blossoming with the multi-domed church buildings so associated with the Eastern Slavs' Orthodox Christianity, a land pregnant with spiritual heritage and strongly in touch with the oldest traditions of the faith. But around the turn of the 20th century, something drastic happened. 1 year after March 1917, when the last Tsar abdicated, militant atheists seized power, leading to the looting of churches, the mocking of religion, and even the murder of priests, monks, and believers by the thousands. To ascribe it all to, quote, the revolution, begs the question. In fact, more than one revolution has occurred in Russia in the first decades of the 20th century. Anti-Tsarist uprisings in 1905 led to a constitutional government with an elected legislature, the Duma, ushering in liberal reform. The March 1917 revolution saw the formation of a provincial provisional government of mainly moderate liberals. None of this directly threatened the church or religion. Instead, Russia experienced a spiritual revival. But the rise and revolution of the Bolsheviks caught the Russian Orthodox Church, ROC, by surprise. At first, the Tsar's abdication seemed to some a chance to free themselves from state control, providing an opportunity to re-establish the patriarchate suppressed by Tsar Peter in 1721. But the Bolsheviks, at first a small conspiratorial party, aimed to smash both church and state. An unprepared church. An unprepared church. Their success hinged on the ROC's close identification with the state, which prevented it from exercising an independent and therefore credible moral authority. Moreover, in an empire only half ethnically Russian, the March Revolution provided an opportunity for other predominantly Orthodox peoples, such as the Belarusians and the Ukrainians, to revive their own traditional churches, long suppressed by the Tsars. Other traditions, like evangelicals and the Baptists, persecuted previously, also benefited from the revolution, at first. The Bolsheviks initially tolerated them because they weakened the established Orthodox Church. Later, of course, they would try to destroy those churches as well. Bolsheviks also capitalized on the peasant population's passivity and latent anti-clericalism. Life was precarious enough, and opposing any authority, Tsarist or Bolshevik, was dangerous. The brutalizing poverty of village life won the party active support. After all, the Russian provisional government only talked about taking land from the rich landowners and giving it to the peasants. The Bolsheviks encouraged it. Alas, one of the largest landowners happened to be the church. The party propagated this image of the church as wealthy exploiter during the famine of 1920 to 1921. Though the ROC set up a relief fund and contributed generously to it, the church, exempted from its donations, objects used in worship. Seizing on this, the Bolsheviks organized their own relief effort, then commanded the church to turn over its sacramental objects. When it refused, the Bolsheviks put its leaders on trial for refusing to help the hungry. Bolshevism soon entered the church through Russian Orthodox seminaries, which became hotbeds of radicalism. Some within the ROC eventually formed the Renovationist Church, which the Bolsheviks manipulated and controlled. When the ROC's patriarch, Tikhon, died, they persuaded his successor, Metropolitan Sergei, to declare the church's loyalty to the Soviet state in 1927. After this, the Bolsheviks suppressed the Renovationists. The tragedy of the Bolsheviks' takeover of Christian land reverberates even today. Still, Christianity survived in the USSR. Yes, it even flourished there. For the Eastern Slavs, Soviet rule was just one more passing trial in the 10-century story of their long-suffering faith. This article was written by Andrew Sorokowski and was first published in issue number 18. Andrew Sorokowski is a retired lawyer, government historian, and academic specialist on the modern history of Ukraine. We have two remaining articles in this issue. The next one is written by Chris A. Armstrong. It is entitled, Why Christian History? 10 Reasons to Study Christian History. Senior editor Chris Armstrong offers 10 good reasons to stay connected to our shared past. Number one, Christian history is everywhere in our culture. No matter what your religious background or lack thereof, you just can't understand the modern Western world unless you know Christian history. Biblical expressions are embedded in our language. Christian ethical positions, though dimly remembered, are now honored most often in the breach. Musical styles, even rock and roll, owe much to slave spirituals and gospel shouts. our context is soaked in forever Christianity. Number two, it liberates you from the tyranny of the present and of the recent past. The ever-quotable C.S. Lewis put it like this, "I don't think we need fear that the study of a day and period, however prolonged, however sympathetic, need be an indulgence in nostalgia or an enslavement to the past. In the individual life, as the psychologists have taught us, it's not the remembered past, it's the forgotten past that enslaves us. And I think that's true of society. I think no class of men are less enslaved to the past than historians. It is the unhistorical who are usually, without knowing it, enslaved to a very recent past." Number three, life is too short to learn by experience. To echo Lewis, the scholar has lived in many times. What a rich way to grow in wisdom. Number four, whatever question is on your mind, someone smarter than you has already seen it more clearly, thought about it longer, and expressed it better. Why reinvent the wheel? Also, falling under this heading, you won't find new heresies, only old ones and new clothes. And again, they'll all have been addressed with more wisdom and your addition than we'll ever be able to muster. Number five, the deeper our roots, the higher we grow. Believers are all part of a dead Christian society. We have far more brothers and sisters in the faith who are no longer around than we do contemporary saints. Let's get to know them. And while we slog it out on earth as members of the church militant, the church triumphant is pulling for us from heaven. Number six, Christian history is a great way to meet fascinating people and hear dramatic, colorful stories. History is all about people, memorable people. Thomas Carlyle wrote, quote, "Biography is the most universally pleasant and profitable of all reading," end quote. Those Victorians had it right, and nothing sizzles like the stories of the saints. Number seven, reading Christian history helps root out prejudice and foster sympathy and humility. It's so easy to think the church are us. It ain't. Most Christian believers look, and have looked, very different from us. They've had different questions, different approaches to the Christian life, and different evangelism strategies, teaching, preaching, sacramental life, social action. That's a good thing, because the church today has a wide and sometimes wild variety of members. Knowing more about the past, we gain insight into the present's problems. We may become less critical and more aware of our shortcomings and limited perspectives. Number eight, reading Christian history shows us how we got where we are today. Where did all those denominations come from? How did the distinctive beliefs and practices of my own church develop? Number nine, it reminds us of our mission. Although we live in the world, we are citizens of another place. We have a strange mission, a mandate to be in this world, but not of it. Whenever we step out of the church doors, we still need to be the church, salt, light, different. We can prepare ourselves for that mission by reading how past Christians sowed the gospel into their cultures. And finally, number 10, Christianity is a historical religion based on a historical person and his actions in the world. 19th century liberal theologians like to talk about the essence of Christianity, little more than the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man that needed to be extricated from centuries of errant doctrines and practices of a church that never seemed to get it right. But there is no essence not clothed in history. Christianity is all about the incarnation of God's second person as a first century Jew from Nazareth. And the New Testament is no philosophical book of abstract teachings. It is a narrative of a life, a sacrifice, a resurrection played out on history's stage. When you read Christian history, you're paging through the 29th chapter of Acts. This article was written by Chris A. Armstrong, who is senior editor of Christian History and has been associated with the magazine since 2002. We have time for just part of the final article in this issue of Christian History, and we'll complete it next week. It's entitled Living for Christ. Why did these martyrs, theologians, missionaries, saints, and preachers make our top 100 most searched topics online? You tell us. This new gallery retells the stories of some of our readers' favorite figures from the past 149 issues. Vibia Perpetua, circa 180 to circa 202, made autobiography come alive. Perpetua, a well-educated Roman, the delight of her father, left a rare treasure, the first known diary by a Christian woman. It vividly records her experiences on death row in 3rd century Carthage. After she was arrested as a Christian, her father was frantic from the scandal and the fear of losing her. He begged her to renounce her faith for the sake of her newborn son. Father, she answered, do you see this picture? I see it. Can it be called by any other name than what it is? No. Neither can I call myself anything but what I am, a Christian. Her father blustered, but left defeated. He and the arguments of the devil. Authorities thrust Perpetua and other Christians into a dungeon. Quote, I was scared because I had never known such darkness, she wrote. Oh, bitter day! There was a great heat because of the closeness of the air. There was cruel handling by the soldiers. Lastly, I was tormented by concern for my baby. Eventually, deacons bribed the guards to move the Christians into better quarters. They granted Perpetua permission to tend to her son, after which she compared the prison to a palace. At trial, Perpetua stood fast. Seeing that she affirmed Christ as Lord, the magistrate ordered her father beaten. Although sorry for her father, Perpetua refused to end his humiliation by sacrificing to the emperor. With the others, she was condemned to face beasts in the arena. Before the games, Perpetua dreamed she defeated a hideous Egyptian. Quote, and I awoke, she wrote, and I understood that I should fight, not with beasts, but against the devil. But I knew that the victory would be mine. End quote. Bound in nets, Perpetua and her slave, Felicitas, were tossed by a mad heifer. Perpetua helped Felicitas up. The two modestly adjusted their garments. Soon afterward, the Christians kissed each other and faced soldiers who finished them off. The inexperienced youth assigned to kill Perpetua struck a bone, causing her agony. She guided his sword to her throat. Her faith inspired other martyrs. Her lively first-person narrative influenced later autobiographies, including, in all likelihood, Augustine's famous Confessions. We'll pick up next week with the story of Origen. I'm Stacy Wilson for the Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.